Welcome to Grimshaw Speakers, a partnership between the Grimshaw Club and the Beaver Sound. We bring you conversations with exceptional individuals discussing the issues of our times.
Today we speak with Andrew Norton, Director of IIED, about action-oriented think tanks and supporting the least developed nations in climate negotiations.
This is a recording from our annual Grimshaw Symposium. Enjoy.
Today we have Andrew Norton with us, the director of IIED, an action-oriented think tank. I'm going to leave Andrew to introduce himself. Don't feel like this is too formal or restrictive. Please pop your hand up with any questions throughout the event. It's very relaxed.
Thanks very much, Yasmina. I was interested to come and speak, seeing the international relations kind of hook for this, because climate change obviously is an area where kind of multilateral governance is failing really badly. So it's a kind of, I mean, there's a lot that can be said that's very downbeat. There are all kinds of ways in which we're not, the world is not hitting the mark it needs to. I'm sure we'll come around to that in the discussion. I'll also talk about some things that are positive and some experiences that I've had working with the International Institute for Environment and Development, which I think have been hugely helpful and helped to kind of move the dial in terms of public engagement and political understanding of climate change. So we'll get to that. I was asked to say a few words about my background. I describe myself usually as an applied anthropologist, spent much of my career in development agencies, the UK Department for International Development. I, for my sins, did two spells in the World Bank as well with the Social Development Group there. And it was actually in the second spell I was there when I started working on climate change. Worked on a work programme called The Social Dimensions of Climate Change with Robin Burns, which published an edition coming out of that that started to explore some of the key social issues, kind of migration, conflict, gender, just social justice and inequality around climate change. But most of my career was in development agencies, and then I shifted to the Overseas Development Institute where I was Director of Research for about 5 years, and then moved to IIED where I'm the Director in 2015. Bizarrely, about in my first 6 months, we had the Paris COP21, the key event for climate change. We had all the events around the Sustainable Development Goals in New York in September and at UNGA. And we also had the Addis Ababa Financing for Development. So I was straight into a sequence of international events. And I guess at that point, it's interesting because looking back, I think we were pretty optimistic at that point about the multilateral process, about the Paris COP, about the Paris Agreement, and we felt, broadly speaking, I think we felt it was going to work. And obviously there have been some kind of major bumps in the road since then, and things that have sucked energy out of the process. We can talk around that, but also talk maybe about the ways in which Paris and the engagement that we had, which was mostly with the least developed countries negotiating group, well, I believe helped also to produce some positive change as well. So that's my background.
Excellent. Thank you very much. It seems like you were thrown in the deep end when you took up your most recent role.
Yeah.
It sounds like a pretty hefty list of tasks for your first day. Can I ask, for those who might not know, can you explain a little bit more in brief about what the International Institute for Environmental Development, IIED, which has offices here in London and Edinburgh,
Yeah. What
they do, and then we can dive a little bit more into their role with least developed countries.
Sure. We work on a range of issues at the intersection of environment and development. The organisation was formed in 1971. Its founder was a woman called Barbara Ward, who's less well known than she should be. She was in many ways the sort of the originator of a lot of what we now call sustainable development. She wrote the position paper with René Dubois for the 1972 Stockholm Conference on the Human Environment, which was an incredibly important moment. At that point, you know, the notions about environmental change and development were in a way not as focused as they became in recent years on climate change and biodiversity loss. It was a sort of broader canvas, pollution, urban development, those kinds of things. But she really was remarkable and gave IID a real flying start. We now have about 125 staff, maybe out of date slightly, but I think it's in that area. And we have a new strategy. Please do take a look at the website. It's called Make Change Happen. You mentioned the action-oriented element. For a think tank, we're unusually focused on action and impact as really the rationale for everything we do. So it's focused on five major challenges. One is cross-cutting and is rising inequality of wealth and income and other dimensions. And then the other four challenges each have a kind of focus group that gives them strategic drive and also does most of the operational work. So obviously we have a climate change group confronting the climate crisis. We have a group that works on a range of natural resource issues, but also land governance and stuff like that, natural resources group. And the challenge that maps to them we've called the assault on the natural world, but primarily we're looking at the sort of alarming data on biodiversity loss, but always trying to make the connection to people, to poor people, to inclusion, to the ways in which even an issue like biodiversity loss that in rich countries is perceived often as being about iconic species with elephants and so on. But poor people are hit hardest by biodiversity loss because the services that nature provides, whether it's for livelihoods, land and forests and so on, or whether it's for protection, like coral reefs and mangroves for storm surge, they can't buy those. And if those natural services degrade, then they will suffer more than others who can buy substitutes for that. So that's the second one. The third one we've called a challenge of increasing urban risk. The world is currently roughly half urban. By 2050, it will be roughly two-thirds urban. And 90% of that change from half to two-thirds will happen in the poorest countries. All rich countries and most middle-income countries have gone through what we call the urban transition and are about as urban as they're going to get. But rates of urbanisation in poor countries are very high. Now, the problem with that is many of these countries don't really have much in the way of planning infrastructure, of institutions and governance systems to manage that. So it could well be that what you get are cities that bake in exclusion, but also bake in high emissions because people are too far away from the centre and, also obviously problems of environmental health and pollution and so on. So that's the third challenge. And the fourth one, we struggle with a name for this, if I'm honest, but we called it unsustainable markets. So it's just that whole area of informal sectors where poor people earn their living and how they get their own livelihoods. We have a fantastic program of work in that also with the LDCs, which is called Blue Economy, but focuses really on the importance of coastal resources for many poor people, a facet of many poor countries, developing countries that I'm sure many of you have seen, is that the coastal populations are often fairly poor because they don't own land and they don't own assets. So coastal resources, fisheries are incredibly important for their livelihoods. So that's a major area of interest for us, and the link to the LDCs is also in a global negotiation. There is currently a process going on which is called Biodiversity Beyond National Jurisdiction, which is a bit hard to unpack, but is really about the governance of the high seas. Half of the planet is not in any governance framework. Half of the planet is the high seas beyond national waters, and there is no effective governance system for that half of the planet. So basically, you have five or six rich countries that don't want it governed because they have the resources to exploit the high seas. And you have a negotiation which is saying, no, this is a common heritage for humanity, the genetic resources, but also the biodiversity in the high seas, a lot of it circulates with coastal fisheries as well. So if you lose that, you also lose livelihoods for like 350 million people, the majority in developing countries who are working in coastal fisheries. And a billion people, I think, are primarily dependent on ocean fish for animal protein as well. So is a massively kind of consequential issue also for poverty. So that's like really quick. We also work on energy. We work on food systems. So there's a range of teams, lots of teams, all focusing in different areas. The climate work obviously is really important. That dates back about 20 years. It was started by a guy called Salim al-Haq, who's now runs, well, he's still part-time for us, but spends most of his time running the International Centre for Climate Change and Development, which is based in Dhaka, Bangladesh. And he kicked off the programme of work with great strategic vision, really focusing in on, I mean, at that time, 20 years ago, he said, a lot of work, activist work, research work, is focused on climate change mitigation. So he set the direction the Institute has followed, which is to focus on the poorest countries, on resilience, on the impacts on the poor, and on adaptation. And those are still kind of the primary areas where we focus. But obviously you can't work on climate change and not work on mitigation. So that's something we also do.
It's really fascinating to hear about, and especially in a university where, you know, we were saying this earlier, but populated by lots of students who are interested in potential research careers, yeah, but still wanting to maintain kind of an emphasis on making change and improvement, yeah, to the world. It seems that IIED has kind of made, yeah, that bridge between those two things. So really fascinating, and I'm sure we'll dive into that a little bit more later in questions.
Sure.
But what we'd really like to know is about the work that IIED does in relation to LDCs. Obviously, as many politics or international relations students here will be fascinated with the dynamics that occur, in negotiations and in the global stage, especially on such a primary and essential topic as climate change and solving this existential issue, and how domestic politics kind of gets to its extreme in this international sphere. So could you lay out where the relationship between IIED and the LDCs began?
Yeah.
And just briefly, what it is that you do to support them in their, yeah, negotiations? And then maybe we can talk about the challenges they're currently facing, their successes, and so on.
Yeah. Okay, so, I mean, at Paris, I think the LDC group, let me start by just describing least developed countries. I don't know if you're familiar with the technical definition. There's a mistake that's commonly made, which is to confuse them with low-income countries, LIC, LICs and LDC, so I'll just do that. The LDC group is a UN-recognised group, has a status in all UN negotiations. They can rock up and say, we are the LDC group and we will do something like the G77 or whatever, these other groups. The LDCs are defined by three sets of criteria. One of them is kind of broadly economic poverty, GNP per capita. Another is the level of institutional capability of the country, a set of measures around that. And the third is a set of human development indicators, kind of child mortality, life expectancy, and so on. So you have this group. They are different to the low-income countries. Low-income countries is a World Bank category simply based on a monetary calculation of the level of GNP per capita. And it doesn't do anything. The LICs don't do anything together, whereas the LDCs do political work together. And it's an interesting category. You have some middle-income countries in there, like Bangladesh is still one, probably graduate soon. But there's a sort of quite a diverse group, including some countries with a bit of geopolitical clout like Bangladesh, which really helps if you're trying to shift the dial in negotiations. So that's the LDCs. I'm not sure exactly when they were created. I think it was the 60s. But it's important to understand the background of what they are. There are now 47 LDCs. There were 48 at Paris. The one that dropped out was Angola, I think, in the meantime. And there will be some others graduating in the near future as well, over the next 5 years. So that's a group. It's mostly African countries. It's got about 4 or 5 Asian countries, and actually a surprising number of Pacific countries. I think Vanuatu, Kiribati, Tuvalu, and Solomon Islands, I think, are all LDCs as well, which is obviously important in the climate context. And just one country in Latin America and the Caribbean, Haiti. And the rest, I think, are African countries. So how how did that work? So when Paris, for example, the LDC group as a whole had 40-something negotiators. So that is less than Saudi Arabia would field on its own. The US would field about, I think, 200 then. Saudi Arabia, I think, I might have got this wrong. So
that's,
I'm going to
so
be quoted,
47 countries have how many?
About 40 or 45 negotiators, as
versus
I recall, there. Versus you'd have more than that just from Saudi Arabia. Most of Saudi Arabia's negotiators are paid for by Saudi Aramco, the oil company. So it's a group that could easily get overpowered in the course of negotiations. Now, you asked me where our IIED's work with them came from. It came from Salim, the guy I mentioned earlier, Salim al-Haq. He kind of started this program of work. And it's grown over time, but there are a sort of range of things. There are some other organizations that support them too, but I think it's fair to say IOD been at the centre for the last 20 years. So one critical thing is to sort of support them to develop effective negotiating capacity. So that can be through training, but it can also be through working with whoever's leading the group, and this changes over time, to sort of structure it so that, let's say, you've got 8 negotiation tracks going into Paris. I think there were 8 that they decided to follow, that you have at least one strong negotiator following each track. Some of that 40-something are people who haven't got a lot of experience. They're usually short on legal expertise. That's an area we've specifically supported them quite a lot. So it's like gap filling, but also making sure that there are strong LDC negotiators in each area. And then there's a range of other things we do as well, helping them prepare briefings, prepare notes that go forward to try and influence the debates and try and influence the negotiations. A range of other things as well. In recent years, we've got more engaged with supporting LDCs in their national policy frameworks as well, and I can talk about that, but that's slightly different, if you like, to the negotiations field. And other bells and whistles. Brianna Kraft, who would have come with me, but she's actually in Madrid. Basically, you've got me because the whole negotiating team is currently in Madrid at the COP. But she's worked quite a lot on gender and sort of trying to train it. In the early days, there were very few women negotiators, and trying to get it more or less to parity in terms of the gender balance of the negotiating teams as well. So there's a range of things that we've helped on within that. Also, at Paris, we also handle press and media. Various times other people have handled that, but we handled it at Paris.
So earlier this morning, we had a chat with Alina, I'm going to get her name wrong, Avanchikova, from the Grantham Institute, and we spoke a lot about Paris and kind of what was different about Paris in terms of negotiation, in terms of strategy, trying to get cooperation between several countries. Through the LDC lens, kind of our conversation touched on, for example, the nationally determined contributions, NDCs, which was new to the Paris Agreement, and the cooperation of many city groups and private sector groups and so on. Through the lens of your experience with LDCs, how did the different kind of strategy of Paris support them, impact them? Was it useful, was it not? Could you speak to Paris specifically?
Sure. Well, you can only really see Paris in the context of the failure of Copenhagen in 2009. The Copenhagen COP, as I'm sure you're all aware, was a car crash. And it's tried to put in place a top-down system with kind of hard accountability around emissions reductions, etc., etc., and that founded on basically the US, as you might expect. I'm not an expert on how exactly Copenhagen collapsed, but anyway, it didn't work. Paris was largely structured, the Paris Agreement. Obviously, this is kind of bookending Barack Obama, that he went to Copenhagen and more or less at the end of his period had Paris, 2015. And he had to work with a Congress that was never going to sign up. I mean, the US, as I'm sure you know, is, I think, now the only country in the world that has never signed the Convention on the Rights of the Child. So yep. There are real problems with the US and multilateral governance, even when you have Democrats.
Yep.
Climate, obviously, it was times many, because over many years, the Koch brothers and others had funded the Republican Party to become basically an organization of climate denial. So you moved from a situation where there were Republicans who were reasonably positioned in relation to the science in the early 2000s, like John McCain, to a situation where there are none. So he was facing all kinds of difficulties with Congress. So they came up with a structure that basically wasn't going to mandate the US to do anything. The US could never have signed that, but was what they called a bottom-up structure, right? So bottom-up offers from all countries. Those were the nationally determined contributions.
Yeah.
Well, INDCs, I think at Paris they were called in, something like interim nationally determined contributions. So terribly counterintuitive language. But anyway, so the LDCs were determined to make Paris a success. They were fundamental to getting, I think, the most consequential thing from Paris, which was adding to 2010's 2-degree mitigation target, the 1.5-degree target, which was added at Paris, which I think really has made the difference, and I can talk about that. But the LDCs were part of a group, along with the Pacific Islands, along with some progressive developed countries, including then the people who are leading for the federal government of the US, but also the EU and so on. So the High Ambition Coalition, as it came to be called. So that was important. But the LDCs also wanted to build a platform going into Paris that wasn't just about asking for climate finance from rich countries. They also had a creative offer from their side in relation to the climate crisis. So I think almost all of the LDCs had submitted an INDC before Paris, and some of them focused on adaptation, but many also were focusing on mitigation, sort of being part of the solution to the global problem as well. Particularly Ethiopia's is, I think, Ethiopia's INDC was one of only two that were rated as adequate by most of the advocacy organisations going in. So there were LDC countries that were really stepping up on the mitigation challenge, as well as looking for ways of dealing with the impacts, which in poor countries obviously are very serious. So that's how they went into it. They went into it determined to have their own national positions, but also determined to be able to make an impact on the big elements of the negotiations.
And I'm going to just ask one more question, then we'll open it up for lots more questions from you guys, so have a think. Actually, it's a two-piece one. In the first instance, so we've had a look at Paris, and we've had a look at LDC's kind of motivation and real aim to make Paris a success. Can you speak to after Paris and
sure.
their kind of progression after that?
Yeah.
Which was very interesting this morning with Alina, was talking a little bit more about the legislation and domestic codification of this guidance that Paris provided. So what progress has been there in the LDC group? Where are the challenges, where are the successes, basically?
I think in terms of national level policy, bearing in mind that this is a group of countries that don't have huge policy apparatus or institutions, I think progress has been fairly strong. We have an initiative that we're supporting them on now called the LIFE-AR, the LDC Initiative for Effective Adaptation and Resilience. And what we're looking for there, what we're looking to there, is for the LDCs to show leadership in terms of a vision, a 2050 vision. And this is, you know, their concept, but a 2050 vision for a climate resilient future. low carbon, but also having done the work that they need to do on their own systems on resilience from the impacts of climate change as well. So that has a vision, but another key part of it is developing mechanisms that will deliver climate finance to the local level. We did a piece of work a couple of years ago that analysed the big multilateral climate funds like the GCF and the climate investment funds at the World Bank, and we found that even at the level of intent, we couldn't really measure what actually reached the ground level. Only 10% of that money was geared towards reaching local institutions, whether it's communities, households, the local government, local private sector. So bearing in mind that that's where most of the work of adaptation is done, it's done by people living in these environments that are degrading.
Yes.
It's kind of shocking that very little money is even intended to reach that level.
And where was the rest of the money going, actually?
Well, a lot of it, some of it obviously goes to mitigation, and you know that's justifiable. We would argue that you know, if the economics is right and advantageous, you don't need to spend public climate finance so much on supporting mitigation in middle-income countries. We would argue that it's better that that goes to the poorest countries, whether for mitigation or adaptation. But a lot of it also just sticks at higher levels, infrastructure work and other kinds of adaptation work, which, you know, you wouldn't spend everything at the local level, but 10% reaching the local level isn't enough. So one of the elements of that offer, the Life AR, the work that the LDC is doing, is a commitment on behalf of the countries. There are sort of six front-runner countries within that, Gambia, Uganda, Bhutan. But one of the elements of their offer is to commit to get 70% of that money to local institutions and to help people at the sharp end to deal with the impacts of climate change. So that's not just about policy. Policy doesn't achieve that. It's also about mechanisms. It's about having robust mechanisms in place to transfer that money as well. So there's a whole suite of things that you need to build to achieve that, some of which are public sector, some of which are private sector. That also links to other work that we've done over the last 10 years on what we've called devolved climate finance, but just ways of building mechanisms, if you like, to deliver climate finance in such a way, not only that it reaches the local level, but that communities have a say in what it's spent on and how it's delivered, and also engage with it. So in terms of, these could be things like rangeland management. Isiolo County in Kenya has a lot of that, but also watershed management and various other kinds of local level resources needed to help communities, like in the drylands, it's mostly about drought. But there are many other problems as well. And we're proud of that work because it started in one county in Kenya and it's now going nationwide in Kenya and also engaged. We're doing similar work in other countries as well. But this is the kind of experience that we're looking to build on. Kenya isn't an LDC, but we're looking to build on within the least developed countries group. Can I say a word actually just about, I mentioned that I thought the 1.5 degree target was important and had shifted the dial, even though obviously many things collapsed. You know, a year after Paris, I was at the Marrakesh COP when people were walking around in shock because the COP coincided with the result of the US election. So, you know, I mean, the US negotiators had gone there hoping that wasn't going to happen. So it has sucked an immense amount of energy out. I think what people said in 2015 about the way it was going to work for mitigation was, there was this phrase people kept using, a signal to the markets, basically a signal that global economy would transition or transform towards renewable energy, towards low carbon industries. These kind of key areas, land use, industry, urban infrastructure, energy, all of these would transform. Obviously, the US election kind of undermined that massively. And we're seeing some really disturbing signs now. There's a lot of indications. China was a real climate champion for several years. Their last five-year plan made a big deal of the shift to renewables. There are really disturbing signals coming out now that the next China five-year plan will involve a pivot towards coal, which is a complete disaster at a global level. So, you know, there are some bad times that would not have happened without Trump. I mean, that's a result of countries feeling that the US might free ride on their efforts and not do anything. And the US obviously has sufficient economic mass that it's critical. So, what's good? Well, the 1.5 degree target at Paris, went alongside with a range of other commitments. Now, at the time, I guess our theory of change was that it would all happen through changes in the markets, changes in global government commitments, through NDCs being implemented. That didn't work so well. But one of the small things that happened at Paris was the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, was mandated to produce three reports related to Paris. The first was the one on the 1.5 degree target, the next was the one on climate change on land, and the third was on the oceans and cryosphere. They're all out now, and they're all worth looking at. Now, I think the 1.5 degree report had a huge impact, not just in terms of governments, and probably not primarily in terms of governments, but in terms of civil society and social movements. When Greta Thunberg went to the US Congress, she gave a very short speech and put the report on the desk and said, I want you all to read this. This is the science. And what it did was, I mean, the IPCC has been criticised a lot for being super cautious about their projections. And indeed, if you look at any of the early AR1, AR2, AR3 and so on, the trajectories they outlined, basically everything's been on the worst possible line in those trajectories. So, you know, there's something in that. But the 1.5 degree report isn't cautious. It lays out the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees, which is hugely material for the world in all kinds of ways, in terms of direct impacts, the risk of tipping points, all kinds of things. It does mention tipping points, which earlier IPCC reports didn't. It mentions particularly that the projections around the carbon budget would be thrown off by 100 gigatons of carbon that could be released from under the permafrost. But it had all of that in it, and it also provided these really clear messages that business as usual wasn't going to work, that you had to have rapid transformations in the four systems they talked about. Now, that's what I just mentioned, energy, industry, land, and urban and infrastructure, and that without that, things weren't going to work. Now, that came out in October 2018, and I think you do see a boost to social movements around climate change. I mean, Extinction had been formed before then. The school climate strikes had started not long before then. I think Greta started sitting outside the
August 2018.
Mm-hmm. But you see a real boost from that point. And I think it made a difference to have something that was credible science, but also really ringing the alarm bell really loud. And the other thing it's done is really take 2 degrees off the table. Very few people talk about 2 degrees as a safe target now, which is right, though obviously alarming that we're not on track to even meet 2 degrees, let alone 1.5. So we wouldn't have had the 1.5 degree report, I think, without a lot. It wasn't only the LDCs. The Marshall Islands, Tony DeBrum was a real key actor in that. The US at the time under Obama supported it, the EU supported it, but I think the LDCs gave it a lot of passion and drive that got it, helped get it over the line. So I don't think we would have anticipated in our theory of change at that time the way in which the LDC engagement at Paris made a difference, but I think it did make a difference in that sense. And obviously there's a long road to travel, but just coming back, reasons to hope. I mentioned the sort of pivotal position of the US, that it's very difficult to see the scale of international transformation in economies happening that we need while the US is acting as a rogue state on climate. But of course there is the election November 2020. And again, a lot of these movements, Sunrise in the US, has been really important in getting the Green New Deal, getting these kind of more radical climate narratives into the Democratic Party. The Sanders plan is pretty radical, the Warren plan is pretty radical. But I think it's reasonable to think that this will even shift the more conservative candidates into a more ambitious space over the course of the period it takes for the Democrats to select their candidate. Now, of course, that candidate might not win, but I think, you know, that's the hope, really. I mean, that if you got a win in the US, I think you would see things moving in terms of China and India. Of course, they worry that it would only be 4 years, it wouldn't be 20 years, but it would still, I think, make a huge difference. So, again, I think it's not just the fact that you have social movements, it's the fact that they could be really consequential. Of course, we have our own election, and that's not consequential on the scale the US one is in terms of global economy, but, you know, every little is going to help, basically.
I think we will end with that. I just want to really quickly touch on the fantastic advice that I asked Andrew ahead of time, if he could maybe prepare a thought for us as students, many of which might want to work in an organisation like IIED or do negotiations in climate. If there was any advice that he could provide, or one of his colleagues. So it would be great if we can just quickly share this as an ending point.
Okay, this is from Anna Schultz, who's recently taken over from Achille Abbasinghe, leading our work with the LDCs. And I asked her to do it because, you know, it's quite a while since I started out, so I thought it might be good to get some more recent experience. So, harder question of how students can follow this path. Get international experience is critical to start with. If you're interested in the negotiations, try and find ways of attending, whether it's through advocacy NGOs, whether it's through think tanks. And obviously there'll be various kinds of opportunities at the Glasgow COP around that as well, which is something that's going to be less difficult to get to. But she's saying the lead time for those kinds of applications is obviously often about 6 months. So that's something to think about. And then just build, you know, concrete practical skills, project management, budgeting, proposal writing, either through courses or through practical experience working with agencies. And also just, I guess in the climate field as well, people are going to be looking for engagement and activism as well, I think, as a signal of commitment and long-term engagement with the issues as well over coming years.
So, she also suggests the point about anyone from every different discipline is a valued kind of member of work in climate. You know, whether that be law, economics, management, that's why it's so interesting to talk about this at LSE. Excellent. Well, I hope everyone will join me in thanking Andrew for...
Thank you.
Many thanks to our speaker, Dr. Andrew Norton. The wonderful music was by Ashley Lyle Marsing. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. For more info on the Grimshaw Club and the Beaver Sound, check out our websites.